Welcome, baseball fans, to episode 25 of the Nats GM Show, the only podcast available via the Nats GM Radio Network. I'm your host, Ryan Sullivan, the newly appointed chairman of NatsGM.com and the baron of all baseball podcasts. My special guest this week is Craig Goldstein. Craig is an author for Baseball Prospectus, a co-host of the podcast There Is No Offseason, and a legitimate fantasy baseball expert. The purveyor of Sandwich Prospectus, this man is a true internet icon. Craig, welcome to the Nats GM Show.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And I really want to thank you for carving out some time on a Sunday. We have the season starting here just in a few days, and I want to pick your brain a little bit about fantasy baseball and also pick your brain about prospects, because I guess we're free to talk about it now. You're going to be a part of the prospect team here going forward.
Yeah, absolutely, and I'm really excited to earn the placement there. So I'm looking to get out there and see a bunch of guys this year.
Well, very cool. Well, Craig, I want to start with a couple of general fantasy questions, if I can, because I am maybe the worst roto player around, and that's really not a good place to be when you run a blog about baseball and podcast galore. It's kind of opens yourself up to some criticism from your buddies. So, despite my trying to outsmart and outthink everybody, I always finish, you know, right in the middle of the pack. So, give me a few general draft strategies that you follow or adhere to, or something that I can do differently than what I've been doing.
Sure. It's obviously very much dependent on the type of leagues that you play in. I specialize, like you said, my podcast is There Is No Offseason, and that refers to Dynasty League format. So those are kind of year-round. They tend to be deeper. Obviously, there are some shallower leagues that do the dynasty format, but you keep a lot of your roster, and there's often a minor league component to it, which obviously plays to my strength. So that's mostly what I play for, and, you know, the biggest thing in almost any fantasy league is preparation. So, like you said, you try and study and outthink people, but, you know, the thing is, it's preparation, but it's also keeping it simple. So, I mean, before anything, it's best player available. We at the fantasy team, we have a service called the Bat Signal, which is, you know, anyone can write in and we will turn around and answer to you within 12 hours. That's the service. And we get a ton of questions, especially this time of year. You know, I'm looking at these people. I have enough outfielders, but the best player available, you know, coming up this season is going to be, you know, Ruzman Castillo for whatever reason, but, you know, and then there's a drop off to another position where I actually have a position of need. And the answer is always best player available. There is a time when positional depth and roster composition factors in, but the players have to be essentially in a dead heat for that to matter. Because, you know, I think the key is to trust yourself to be able to move, you know, if you've got a surplus of outfielders, you know, trade one and shore up the position that you need. And if you need to give back a little talent in that slot, you can, but when it comes to drafting, it's all about picking the best player, you know, whenever you can.
Okay, so best player available, that's the strategy I'm going to start going with. Okay, so, but that leads to you mentioned a lot in there and a lot of different questions that I want to touch on. First place is the benefits of, I know you mentioned the Dynasty League, and believe me, I understand the benefits of that, but what are your thoughts on an auction draft versus, I guess, what they call it, a snake draft, or, you know, back and forth the way it goes?
Sure. So in general, I think auction drafts are better if you care about disparate, you know, so, for example, if you've got a strong top seven players, and you're in a 12-team league, you know, let's say it's a redraft, and you've got, you know, whoever gets Mike Trout, you know, whoever gets that first pick gets Mike Trout, and that's a huge advantage to have, right? Even though they're not going to pick for another 20 picks. You know, the advantage of the auction draft is everyone gets a shot at every player. And that's kind of why I like auction drafts, because, you know, if you want Mike Trout, you have to really pay through the nose to get him. And, you know, everyone has the opportunity to either do that or decline to do that to spread their money out a little differently. You know, the snake draft is a lot more luck, and I think if you're looking for a flicker draft, you want to do a snake draft. If you're willing to dedicate, so I've been in auction drafts that have taken 5 hours. You know, so they do take a long time, and there is a little more preparation required in terms of how you want to divvy up your dollars and where you want to allocate your money. But I do think in terms of fairness and in terms of giving everyone a shot at every player, the auction draft's the way to go.
So how many leagues will you play in this year, and how many will be auctions versus how many will be, you know, the snake draft?
So I'm going to be in, look, I think I'm committed to 7, and the odds are, I think odds are I'll have at least one more. I did 8 last year. The honest truth is, none of those are auction drafts for me. They're all snake drafts, but they're all also, none of them are redrafts. So, and when I say that, that's basically like, you get together with the same group of guys and you start your team from scratch all over again. Every league that I play in is either a keeper league or a dynasty.
So is that just personal preference, or is that, why is that, I guess, for lack of a better way to ask that question?
It's just kind of how it's worked out. I've been in, so I have, one of the leagues I'm in is PDGS, which is, Brett Fair, who heads up the fantasy baseball team at Baseball Perspective, has his personal site, the Dynasty Guru. And I have a team over there, and that's a 20-team Dynasty League that he actually, it was a snake draft, but what he did when we started it last year was he used something that he called the invisible hand theory. And so what that was he allowed people to bid keeper spots on certain draft slots. So if I wanted Mike Trout, I could have bid 20 keeper spots, and come the end of this season, I would only be able to keep 15 players instead of the 35 that everyone else. So that was an interesting kind of bridge between the auction and stake draft format. I thought everything else is kind of leagues that I've joined in over the years, and like you said, it's a little bit of a personal preference. I obviously like deeper leagues that have a minor league system. So two of my leagues, one of them's an AL only, one of them's NL only, and they have 30-man minor league systems, and they're 10 teams. So that goes kind of 300 prospects deep in AL and 300 deep in NL. So I like those leagues where you really have to dig personally, and it's just hard for me to calibrate those with the same type of redraft leagues where people are, you know, if you're in a 10-team redraft league, it's just an entirely different experience.
Okay, well, let me ask you, this is probably a dopey question, but let's say that I want to find a dynasty league. How do I go about finding one if I'm, you know, I don't know 9 other, you know, diehard baseball fans?
Yeah, that's actually a great question, and it's one that we received. So all the leagues I've been in kind of, I've been referred to by friends, and that's obviously not something that you can necessarily just, hey, go out and ask your friends if they know of any. I think Twitter is a great medium. I've had people tweet me and say, you know, I'm looking for a league, and someone help me out, and I'll retweet them unless I know of a league, in which case I'm happy to refer somebody. But I think a lot of this stuff happens through forums on websites. I used to be on the forums at RotoWorld a decent amount, and I constantly saw people saying, you know, I'm trying to get a league together. I'm looking for this. I think if you go and look at, you know, the different sites that offer fantasy baseball, CBS is probably the best one for dynasty or deeper leagues, because they allow you to add a minor leaguer, or, you know, they have a really deep minor league options available in terms of player pool, and they also allow you to roster minor leaguers that don't count against your major league limit. They have a really nice system for it, but you do have to pay for it. I imagine Yahoo and ESPN also, if you're able to get on their message boards and stuff like that, have people saying, you know, we're looking for someone for a league, or I'm looking to start a league. That also happens, you know, I wrote for fake teams when I started out at SB Nation, and that happens over there all the time as well. So I think, you know, if you're looking at fantasy baseball sites, if you look at, if they have a forum, that's the way to go, or if they have comments, people will often be in there.
Okay, very cool. I've used Roto World like everybody, but I've actually never used their chat forums. But that's a good tip. I never thought of that. So,
yeah, and actually, they have a pretty robust. You know, their forums are you get everyone in there, but there are a lot of knowledgeable people who are willing to go back and forth. So it's a good spot to be.
Okay. Next question I want to ask you is this is kind of a general baseball question, but it gets to fantasy, but. With the decline of offense in the last few years for, whatever reason, I don't want to head there, are hitters now comparably more valuable in fantasy leagues than pitchers?
To some extent, yes. At the same time, it kind of depends because you're comparing them to each other. And so if there are pitchers who have gotten relatively better from where we were 2 years ago, like, the amount that they've gotten better in the last few years has superseded the amount that the league has gotten worse. And so that pitcher is obviously not as affected. But I think on the whole, the answer is yes. And I would also add that hitters are inherently more valuable than pitchers in fantasy leagues. And it's at least in 5x5 leagues, which is the standard. And that's because hitters can affect every category. You have runs, RBIs, home runs, stolen bases, and batting average. Those are your standard five. And a good hitter, if you're Mike Trout, you're checking off every single box there. If you're in the standard 5x5 on the pitching side, you've got wins, ERA, whiff, strikeouts, and save. And so, obviously, even the best starter, Clayton Kershaw, he's not going to help you add saves in there. So he's already at a disadvantage from any hitter. So he's got to separate himself from pitchers on an entirely other level in that sense. And that's why hitters are always drafted higher on top of, you've got the adage that they're safe. You tend not to lose hitters for an entire year the way that you do pitchers when there's an injury. So those are the inherent advantages for hitters. And then the good hitters are comparably more valuable than the good pitchers in fantasy leagues, but I think you're seeing towards the middle that, these kind of mid-tier pitchers, these guys like Tanner Roark, who are putting up, sub-3 ERAs, someone like that last year is going to be a lot more valuable than someone who, your mid-tier or maybe back of the middle type of hitter who just isn't that good. They're not contributing that much. But, again, all of that, in some sense, matters only within the hitting and pitching tiers. Was how many guys were able to do what Roark was able to do versus how many guys were able to do what some sort of generic hitter would do. I don't know if that made entire sense. I don't know if I was able to communicate what I'm saying exactly, but, again, with the decline in offense, it certainly looks worse than a few years ago, but if all of the league is taking a step back, it's only about what's relative, to the other hitters around, if that makes any sense.
No, that makes sense. But I think that gives a perfect example of me trying to outthink my league of, pitching is perhaps less valuable overall, so now I need to draft more hitters than I do, use my first 6 picks on bats rather than, still thinking about pitching. So,
yeah, I think that's definitely something you see people do, and it can depend on the league and how it's structured and what your categories are. But, pitchers are important, too, and I think the reason they tend to get pushed down is there are a lot of pitchers. And I think that's where, again, when you're talking about good bats versus good pitchers, you want to pick the bat because there is a drop-off coming. Where, again, someone like Tanner Roark was able to put up an incredible season without being someone you would need to either spend a lot of auction dollars on or an early draft pick on. Because there are so many pitchers that are able to do such, put up such good production, you can kind of tend to wait on them, whereas, those hitters that are doing comparably good but not great production, those guys you need to go heavy on either, spending an auction or picking early. But once those guys are gone, absolutely be willing to take the talent wherever it is. And again, that's player available type strategy.
Gotcha. Okay, I want to ask one more general question before I dive into actual specific players. your theory on, and I know it's a Matthew Berry idea, but paying for saves, where do you stand on that, you know, overarching cliche, for lack of a better explanation or question?
I'm a subscriber to the Matthew Berry don't pay for saves strategy. Here's my caveat. If your team, for example, if you're in a keeper and your team has everything it needs and you are missing saves, then absolutely spend early on saves. But again, and this is the thing that people tend to struggle with. When we have to give fantasy advice, we're giving fantasy advice to a huge group of people. And so we want to hit as many people as possible and be right for as many people. There are always going to be exceptions where sometimes the right move is to go draft the closer early or to take the pitcher over the hitter, you know, depending on the context. But in general, I think it's a really bad move to pay for saves. And the reason is just that closers are high variance, you know? These are high beta players, even the best ones, even your Kimbrels and your Chapman. I mean, Chapman got hit in the head with a comebacker last year, and, you know, he came back and was amazing, but there's a chance, you know, in the future that he doesn't. Or something, you know, he's at risk for all the things that pitchers are, plus a random offseason for a closer hurts a lot more than, you know, it doesn't get, because it's only 60 to 80 innings that they throw, it hurts their overall numbers more than a poor 30 innings might for a starter, if that makes sense.
No, very much so. Yeah.
30 bad innings from a closer is half their season or so. 30 bad innings from a starter is 4 starts.
Yeah, that's true. And they can only, like you referred to earlier, they help you, you know, a little bit in the other categories, but they only help really in one category, which is saves in a lot of ways.
Right, and that's a great point. When we're talking about how hitters are at an advantage over pitchers, you know, that's even just starters, and they hit 4 categories. Closers hit 1. If you get an elite one, they'll help you in strikeouts. If you get hit, and they'll help you with your race stats, but not to the degree that, you know, even maybe a middle-of-the-pack starter would.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the biggest or the best tools is just seeing at the end of the day when you have a couple of closers get a save and they've pitched 1 or 2 innings, but your starter has had a bad game, you see how little it really affects you, you know, towards your bottom line.
No, that is a great example. It, you know, pay attention to that happening and you'll see, you know, it's not helping all that much.
So, okay, now I want to, if I can go a little more specific now, I want to ask you about a few specific major leaguers and your thoughts on them this year.
Absolutely.
I want to start Nats. I know you're a national. You live in the area, so you know you definitely cover may not be the right word, but you're definitely well acquainted with the Nationals. Bryce Harper and Anthony Rendon. Is this Bryce's kind of breakout season that we've been gambling on the last couple of years? And what are your thoughts on Rendon? Does he suffer the sophomore slump, or does he have, you know, even more, you know, of a breakout to go?
So I'll handle Bryce first, and I'll say that I will be predicting Bryce Harper to have a breakout for MVP season every year for the next 10 years until it happens. Like, obviously you're very in touch with, you know, the national community, but it kind of blows my mind sometimes the blowback that he receives. I mean, again, this is a guy who's going to be, what, 22 years old this coming season? Most of those guys aren't even in the majors, and he's been here for 3 years. Bryce Harper is a generational talent, and he's certainly overshadowed by Mike Trout, who is just insane, but you should just keep in mind that we're lucky enough to see two talents like that come in within a year of each other. It's really amazing. I absolutely think, you know, the key to Bryce Harper right now is just him being healthy. He had knee surgery going into last season. He tweaked his hamstring. You know, I think we kind of think these guys have surgery and then they're fixed. But the reality is that, you know, if you've ever had surgery, it takes a long time for you to feel back to normal again. And they might be able to play. They might be in playing shape. They might technically, physically be 100%. But between that mental and physical connection in terms of trusting your knee or trusting your elbow, whatever it is, that can take a long time to come back. And I think, you know, we see it with guys with shoulder surgery all the time. Matt Kemp took a long time to come back from his shoulder surgery. Adrian Gonzalez took a year and a half until his shoulder finally started coming back into shape, and he was able to hit for a little more power. You know, those are the things that matter. And Harper is a guy who generates a ton of violence in his swing, and it's controlled violence, but he puts a lot of torque on his body, and his knees are a big part of that, you know, being able to have stability. And I don't know anything that anyone else doesn't know. But I would imagine that having off-season knee surgery definitely played a part into his season and his inability to kind of be the guy that we thought he was going to be. And it started early. I mean, he slumped early last season, and it took him a while to kind of come out of it. But the bottom line is his talent is still in the upper echelon within baseball. And I don't know. I think I'll predict him for an MVP season, like I said, every year for the next 10 years until it happens. I think he's an MVP quality player.
Yeah, I think Bryce is actually in a unique position right now with him being so talented, but the Nationals have had, you know, the Scherzer signing, and will they trade Zimmerman or Strasburg, and Worth got hurt a little bit. So he feels very much like an afterthought in Zimmerman moving positions, just another one off the top of my head. It just feels like Harper is so far down the list compared to his talent level that maybe this isn't a bad thing for the first time in his life that he isn't the main story.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good way to look at it. But and I understand all the questions around him. You know, I understand he's a bit of a brash player. That's something I personally love. I love guys with attitude who will show it on the field. I think it's great for the game of baseball. And I understand it ruffles feathers. But, you know, that's something I love to see. I love his confidence in himself. You know, I think we started to see a little bit of who he was. I just think back to that absolutely monster home run he hit off Hunter Strickland in the playoffs last year.
Which one?
Right. Exactly. But I'm thinking of the one in San Francisco. But again, either if you want to talk about either one, you're talking about a guy with a bat speed to catch up to upper 90s velocity, high in the zone, and pull it. I mean, those guys do not grow on trees, you know? And even if he thought the fastball was coming and was able to kind of release early on his swing and cheat a little bit, I mean, Bryce Harper is just like I said, a generational talent, and I'm really hoping people bear with him a little bit because, again, he's 22 years old. You know, we see some of these guys that blossom a little later, and I mean, look how long it took Alex Gordon to become who he was, and he was college product. You know?
That's a great point.
Outfield and some of these guys just take a little bit, and that's okay. You know, it's something that definitely happens. We've got prospect fatigue where there's guys that we've heard about. It's not even that they've done badly. Bryce hasn't done bad. If you look at, like, his career stats for guys at his age, like what people have done by the time he's done it, he's often near the top. And he's often in the company of Hall of Famers. But, you know, again, we know what he could be, and so it can be frustrating to see that he's not there yet. But again, you know, these guys, these are kids, they're people. You know, they struggle with failure and have to deal with adversity. And, you know, it's my belief Bryce is a really mentally strong guy. He will work as hard as he possibly can to be as good as he possibly can. And that's why I'm willing to, you know, throw my weight behind him as an MVP type talent year in and year out.
All right, last thing on Bryce. In a regular redraft league, where is he picked?
See, and this is the difference because in a dynasty league, he's a top four guy, right?
Right.
You've got Trout, Papuchin, Giancarlo, and Harper. And I would even potentially be willing to take Harper over Giancarlo, depending on the circumstance. In a redraft league, he's easily a top two round guy for me. I'd probably take him, I mean, depending on the size of the league, I'd take him towards the bottom of the first round, top of the second, but again, I'm a believer. I think, you know, somewhere in the 8 to 14 range, depending on how the other picks go. He's someone, like I said, I think he could be a 40 home run guy in this season if he can just stay on the field.
Yeah, I tend to agree. We could talk Harper all day, but I gotta move on. Thoughts on Anthony Rendon?
Yeah. Oh, just I mean, and we can. Anthony Rendon is a guy who I watch the Nationals, and I sit there and I watch their games, and I think he's the best player on the field. And that's even though everything I just said about Bryce Harper is true, and I think Bryce Harper is the best player on this team and the most talented player on this team. But when you watch the games and you watch Rendon, everything that he does, it's hard not to think he's not the best player on the team. So that's my phrase for Anthony Rendon, is that when you're watching him, it's really hard not to think he's better than Bryce Harper. I think Bryce Harper is better, but Rendon is amazing. I don't think we're going to see a sophomore slump. I don't know that he'll expand on his breakout dramatically. I don't think he has to. If he can do what he did last year every year, I mean, he's an incredible player. And I think being at third will help him. He's got incredible hands. He really works on his defensive second, but he's made to play third base. I think he has gold-glove quality defense there. I think it's going to be hard for him to get that because Nolan Arenado is a monster on defense in Colorado. But I think Rendon can definitely challenge him for the gold glove, and obviously his bat is something special.
Yeah, I think... And Rendon it reminds me a little of Ryan Zimmerman. You got to watch him every day to realize how good he is in some ways. But Rendon, is, like you say, I think that's a great way to say it. He is the best player on the team. And he is so good. It's just so amazing that he's 24 years old or whatever he is.
And like you said, it's those little things that he does, that you really, the way he can come in on a ground ball. And even at the plate, the pitches that he spits on and the way he can get his hands around on inside pitches. I mean, he's, you know, the NL East has a lot of young talent, and a lot of it's on the Nationals. But he's a guy that, along with Christian Yelich, are some of my favorite guys to watch in their bat on, just because of how they're able to, you know, see what the pitcher is doing and work the counts and fit on pitcher's pitches and really make someone come to them. Or even, you know, when they're down an account, they can challenge a guy and take a pitcher's pitch and turn it into a hit. It's really amazing. Those are two guys that I think are going to be a blast to watch in the NL East. Over the next 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, even Rendon's outs are special at times, and that's sometimes
that's
the mark.
Great way to say it. That's a great way to say it.
So, okay, let's head up 95 a little bit. Let's talk Orioles. They got a couple of interesting bats that I want to get your thoughts on. Machado and Chris Davis. What do you see for them in 2015?
So I'll start with Machado. He's another guy like Harper. You know, it's easy to say it's all about his health, because he shows a lot of really promising signs when he's on the field, but obviously it's concerning to have surgery on both his knees at this point already. I also think, you know, there was a lot of people that thought that Machado, when Machado had, I think he had like 50-something doubles, where he had like 37 doubles at the break, a couple years ago when he had his mostly healthy year, you know, they thought eventually those are going to start turning into home runs. He's going to be just an absolute monster. I think he can still be a monster. I think those are, I'm of the belief that those aren't necessarily going to turn into home runs. I think he's going to be a huge extra base hit guy. But I think he might be more comparable to someone like Rendon than someone like Harper, if that makes sense, in terms of his line at the plate. He should be able to hit, you know, 270s, 280s. I think he's going to rack up a ton of extra base hits, maybe in the 18 to 22 range for home runs and gold glove third base. And, you know, like I said about Rendon, when you watch someone like that, that can be the best guy on the team. I certainly think that can be the case for Machado down the line. I'm a little iffy on predicting that type of success for him this year, just because, again, what I said about Harper in terms of coming off knee surgery and stuff like that, I think it takes time to really trust the joint again, trust yourself at the plate, and we'll see if he's done it before, so maybe it comes a little faster this time around. But, you know, I'm just a little iffy on predicting that type of success in 2015, although I still love the guy long term.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Machado's the kind of guy I draft in fantasy. So that's basically a nice way of saying don't draft him this year. Draft him next year.
Yeah, if you're doing a redraft league, I think 2016 is the year for Machado. And if you're in a keeper league, maybe just see if he gets off to a slow start and acquire him then. You know, try and buy low on a guy that you think is going to get there. It's just the health thing, getting comfortable at the plate again after missing so much time over the last 2 years.
Yeah. What do you see for Chris Davis?
I think we see a return to the 2013 style Davis. I don't think we're going to see 57 home runs again. But, you know, I think 30 is easy. I mean, I think he would have cleared 30 last year while he hit under 200. I mean, he's obviously an incredible power bat. He was rolling over on a lot of balls. His trigger looked a little slow at times. I think the shift might have gotten into his head a little bit, although it's not like he wasn't shifted in years prior. I think he's a guy that can come to spring training with a clean slate and kind of just start over in that sense mentally, take a mental reset. Because I think he really dug himself into a hole. I did an article on him midseason, and I kind of predicted that I thought there was no viable reason for him not to be going back to his former self, except that it might be a mental thing and that it was affecting his ability to kind of have everything sync up at the plate. And I kind of still buy into that. I don't, obviously the Adderall thing was a negative. It's a blemish on his resume, but I don't think it necessarily makes a big difference in terms of what you can expect from him going forward. I think as long as he's confident mentally with where he's at, he can be a 260, 30 homer bat going forward.
Oh, so you believe. Okay, that's good to hear. All right.
Yeah, I do. I believe in... I think he figured something out a few years ago. I don't think, that talent doesn't just disappear. And even the thing is, what you brought up earlier with offense declining league-wise, if he's only a 240 bat with that type of power, that's a valuable player. I do think he can be better than that, but the average is what's in question, not the power. Because he had 26 home runs while hitting under 200. He has some bad luck on balls in play, and some of that, you have to be careful with Babbitt because, everyone starts to attribute it to luck, but sometimes you earn your luck in that sense with weak contact, and I think that was definitely happening to Davis, but that's not something that generally happened to him before, so I'm inclined to think he did something he can say.
Okay, so I'm going to draft him this year, okay, because of you. All right, sounds good. One final fantasy question for you, Craig, and I'm going a little off script, but give me one, I hate the word sleeper, but undervalued player that's going to be on all your teams that I can draft this year and look really smart.
Oh, no. This is where you get me. It's because I have all these sleeper leagues, so it tends not to be someone I know who's sliding down rankings in that sense. Let me take a look here. Someone I like. So... this is a guy, I don't know that he's sliding down drafts, but he's kind of underappreciated, and I have him, and this is, I'm in the boat with you if you go for him. Corey Dickerson in Colorado put up a monster season last year, and he's just someone who kicked his entire career, but never got a ton of prospect love, wasn't getting a lot of love in terms of pedigree, and I think he's going to be, I think he can do something close to what he did last year. I think he had a OPS over 1,000 at Coors last year. I don't think he's necessarily that good as a base talent, but you're talking about a left-handed hitter in Coors who I think he was still something like a 775 OPS on the road, and so that's above league average, really, even for outfielders, and he's someone I really like. I think they're going to let him play against lefties a little more. He struggled with that in the past, but I'm of the mind that lefties tend to struggle against good lefties because they don't get to see him that much. And I believe in his ability to adjust. So I don't know if that's someone who's that far under the radar in terms of what you're talking about, but he's someone I think I think people are already discounting him a little bit because it's a force factor because we didn't really know much about him. But he's someone I really like, and I have him on at least three teams. So I'm in there with you.
Yeah, I think that's a great name. I think he suffers a bit from being the other Corey Dickerson kind of syndrome.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah.
So I think that's a great name, and I'm with you on that one. I think that's a good call, and that's definitely kind of the type of player I was looking for. So,
right.
In your answer, you said something about prospects, and I would be remiss. I think we talk prospects every week on this show. There's nothing I really like better than the minor leagues and talking about the future. So, a couple of prospects I want to get your opinion on, maybe briefly here. Chance Sisko for the Orioles. This is Prospect Week here on my site. I'm going to be writing about the Orioles and the Nationals in the next couple weeks. Thoughts on Chance Sisko?
Yeah, Tucker Blair, who I don't know if he's had on or not, but he's...
I have, and he gets a mention every week, so hello, Tucker.
As well he should. He's one of the hardest-working guys out there. He started me off just so really early. He was, I believe, a third-round pick for the Orioles a few years ago. He is... And he's just an incredible pure hitter. He was a shortstop on his high school team. They converted him behind the plate. He's definitely still raw there. There's a chance he doesn't stick. But if he doesn't, given his athleticism, I think there's a chance he plays third base or even second base. And while it might not be a conventional profile for the hot corner, he's someone who's able to hit and provide enough pop that the overall value is going to be there, even if it's not the power-heavy approach that kind of typifies the third base profile. And at second base, I think, you know, he could be someone in the mold of, yeah, and again, I don't like to do comps a ton, but when you're talking about in the mold of maybe Neil Walker with maybe a little less power, I don't think he's got 20 homers in his bat, but you're talking about a high average, good approach at the plate. He's not your typical second baseman defensively in terms of his size, but he kind of gets the job done in that sense. And again, if that's someone who can stick behind the plate, you're talking about a really valuable player. Really high average, 10 to 15 home runs down the line. He's just someone who set the Valley League on fire. He's 340 this year. And I'm really excited to take a look at him in Frederick this coming season.
Yeah, I think there are prospects that we'll see that are better this year, but I'm not sure there's a prospect I'm more looking forward to watching than Sisko at Frederick all season. I think he is a legitimate six bat. I think he can flat out hit a baseball.
Yeah, he absolutely raked, and you know, the Orioles, they traded away one of the guys I was looking forward to seeing in Stephen Carpley. They moved him in the deal that brought Travis Snyder to the O's, and, you know, so in terms of Orioles prospects, I'm excited to see. It's Bundy, and then it's this.
Yeah, that's a good call. Although Hunter Harvey's right there, too. That's
Hunter Harvey is right there, too. That's a great point. I shouldn't leave him out. But those three, it's kind of those three. And then you're kind of like, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, that's very true. Which leads to maybe the number four prospect on most lists. excuse me, Christian Walker. Are you a believer or not? I can't figure him out.
I'm not. And that's not to say that I think he's a fine. I think he's someone who will be a major leader. He's obviously been at the major league level already. But you're talking about someone who had a huge power strike last year. A little smaller for your standard first baseman, and I don't think the power surge was really sustainable. He doesn't use his lower half a ton when he swings, and so I don't think that's something that carries over to the kind of elite stuff he's going to be facing in the major league. And, you know, I think he defines potential for being that at first base and DH, but that's obviously not something that's super exciting. It's definitely something that's valuable and shouldn't be overlooked. If, you know, if you're the Orioles, you're not unhappy with that, because there's a lot of value in that, especially for someone making the major league minimum. But it's not someone that you're necessarily relying on day in and day out.
Yeah, I think that's a great call. I think sometimes we overlook, you know, solid everyday regular players as prospects when, you know, there's a lot of value in that, particularly, as, you know, if you can get a solid bat for 4 or 5 years before they become expensive.
Exactly. So. I mean, that's, you know, there's, like you said, there's a lot of value in a guy like that. Even you know, once they hit their arbitration and stuff like that, it's, you know, the price is still depressed, and that's someone who's a useful piece that people go out. I mean, we saw the Angels trade for Matt Joyce, and, you know, they traded a reliever, but it was something they cost them something, and Matt Joyce is kind of, you know, like I said, he's a platoon guy who you can run out there, you know, against, for him, it's, you know, right-handed pitchers, but that's a useful piece when you've got someone who's going to mask one side of certain pitch.
Yeah, that's very true. Shift to the Nats real quick. Thoughts on Trey Turner? I guess, you know, player to be named. He'll be here in June.
Yeah, I you know, Turner is an interesting guy for me. He's someone I saw before the draft, and I saw him have, it was only one game, I didn't get to the whole series, but I saw him have a bad game. He wasn't even running that well. But at the same time, it was in February. He had kind of a severe backside collapse from his swing. That he can get a little long in his swing, and he's definitely not a power hitter. Everything I've heard kind of from that point forward has been glowing about the guy. So I think he's a great addition. I, you know, I tweeted it out at the time. I think Mike Rizzo, I don't know if he's made a bad trade. I honestly can't figure one out. But, you know, Turner is I think there's a little question as to whether he's picked a shortstop. I'm of the mind that he does. And if he can do that, even if he's a guy who kind of hits 250 and doesn't get on base a ton, his speed is going to work in a lineup. Now, that might be at the bottom of the lineup, but for someone who can, you know, if you can play on that shortstop and get that type of speed on the field, at worst, you're kind of looking at someone like an Alcides Escobar, although he's obviously a superlative defender. But you're looking at that type of production on offense, and I think there's room for more than that offensively. So I think it's unfortunate that he doesn't get the development sign in the Nats system right at the start of the season, but I don't think it'll hurt him too much in the long term.
Yeah, I like a right-handed D.D. Gregorius as kind of his floor.
Can
go pick it, little pop, you know.
Defensively, it's a little different, you know, a story. But offensively, I think that's a reasonable angle.
Yeah, that's more what I mean by the offense, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Michael Taylor, just what do you think on him? Are you concerned about the hit tool, or do you think he's Mike Cameron light?
I would say I'm more concerned about the hit tool. I've come around on him a bit as a prospect, but his offensive explosion was a little bit Babbitt fueled. And again, like I said, that's something you can earn bad luck. You can certainly earn good luck if you're hitting the ball hard. And that's something Taylor does really well, but it's also out of line with his career profile in a sense. And so I think he's someone who's going to swing and miss a lot. I think he will make hard contact at times, but I don't think he's kind of the 300 hitter who showed at Double-A. And I know he reached the major league level. I think he can be a really good defender in center, so I don't think by any means he has to be a 300 hitter. I think he can be a 250 hitter and be plenty valuable because I think he can hit, you know, somewhere in the 20 home run range down the line. And the thing is that I think he's someone that fans are going to learn to love because his tools are so loud. I mean, again, like I said, there's a lot of swing and miss, but when he makes good contact, everybody knows it. There's a really good sound off the bat. He runs really well, and it looks really good when he's doing it. So there's a lot to like about Michael Taylor, but at the same time, I think, you know, there are some glaring flaws that are going to be exposed over time at the major league level and make him be more of a second division player than a perennial.
Yeah, I remember watching him take BP in spring training 2012 just on the backfield, and when he was making contact, it sounded like a shotgun blast. I'll never forget that because it sounded so different. And when people say it sounds different off some guy's bat, that was the first time I really heard it as being really different.
Yeah, and that's a great point. He's someone who you don't have to be an evaluator to say, oh, he's really good at this thing, you know, because it shows itself. It's very evident. It's not something you have to have necessarily a trained eye with him because it's just raw talent and athleticism. And like you said, when he makes contact, everybody knows it. But I do think that can blind people when he has success to the times that he doesn't. You know what I mean?
No, and that's perfectly well said. That was the other point I wanted to make. I also saw him have way too many bad at-bats at Potomac for 3 years to all of a sudden believe that this 300 hitter is a real thing going forward. I mean, I just saw too many bad at-bats to believe that this is what he is.
Exactly. And I think the truth, you know, as it often is, although not always, is somewhere in between. I think he probably made some adjustments that really helped him out and that he'll carry with him going forward. But I think he also probably, you know, he was beating up on guys or he was a little older then and this approach, this new adjustment kind of helped him master that level. But he's going to have to start, you know, he's going to have to do the same thing without the 3 years in IA. You know what I mean?
So
he's not going to get that long to adjust at the major league level.
That's a great point. I could pick your brain about prospects all day, but we're starting to bump up on the 45-minute mark, so I probably need to cut it there. And we need to jump into the lightning round if I can.
Absolutely.
So a couple of quick, very quick questions. First thing that comes to the top of your head.
Okay.
Definition of a sandwich.
Uh, For me, it has to be something that resembles, has bread or something bread-like. I'm of the mind that wraps our sandwiches. And so, you know, we're gonna get to a couple of the other things that I believe are sandwiches in a second here. But handheld, and again, it's like a bread or bread-like product, on the outside. I mean, that's the base definition. I could get into it further, but that's the base definition.
Okay, is pizza a sandwich?
There was a time in my mind where I questioned whether it was an open-faced sandwich. I settled on the fact that no, it is not, because I don't think that pizza dough and bread are necessarily the same thing in that sense.
Okay, interesting distinction. Okay, is a burrito a sandwich?
See, and this is where I say yes. Like I said, with a wrap, a burrito is a sandwich. I think the tortilla and bread act as, you know, they have the same function.
Okay, fair enough. So the next one, is a taco a sandwich, both hard shell and soft shell?
Yes and yes. Both are sandwiches. It's tacos and burritos really aren't that different. So it's more of the same.
Yeah, I guess one's open and one's, you know, a wrap. Okay, fair enough. Good point. Is ravioli a sandwich?
See, and this is where I say no. I think pasta, and I understand it's all dough, but pasta and pizza in those senses are different. I understand it encompasses the meat or the vegetable that's in there, or cheese, but for me, if you're cooking with the rest of the item, you're cooking the dough with it, it's not a sandwich, right? And that's the thing where pizza dough is different. You cook it with the pizza. With ravioli, everything's getting cooked together, so it's not a sandwich.
Okay. I see the distinction. Okay. Last one. Is a s'more a sandwich?
See, I saw this, and I still don't have a good answer for you. I think by my own definition, I have to say yes, but I'm not sure that... I'm unsure if crackers, you know, the graham cracker, is serving the same function. I mean, it is serving the same function, but is it kind of the same idea as bread? And that's where I'm not sure. But I'm open to the... If someone wanted to argue it with me, I'd be open.
And you are cooking it along with the bread, though. That is another part of the...
That is true. That's a good point.
So, okay. So you're going to take a pass on s'mores?
I'm unsure. I'm going to say I'm in the middle, and if someone wants to discuss it with me, I'm open to it.
Okay, fair enough. I'm good with that. Best non-sandwich in D.C.?
Best non-sandwich?
Yes.
Oh, wow. I didn't even think of that. I was sitting here thinking about best sandwich in D.C., and I missed that one entirely. Oh, man. I don't know. I'm gonna have to get back to you on that one.
Okay. Best sandwich in D.C., then.
So in D.C. proper, I'm going to say my favorite sandwich is the pastrami sandwich at Kangaroo Boxing Club in Columbia Heights. They started out as a food truck that I used to visit, and ended up being in a brick-and-mortar building. It's some of the best pastrami out there. I absolutely love it.
What's the name of the place again? Give it a good plug.
Kangaroo Boxing Club.
All right. Boxing in Columbia Heights. Okay.
Yeah, and I will add one more thing. So I'm from Bethesda, Maryland, which is a suburb a little bit outside of D.C., and one of my favorite places to go there is called Louisiana Kitchen. They have something called a chicken steak and cheese, and it's to die for.
Very, very good tip.
Really good Cajun food. Really good Cajun food.
Yeah, I'm in Bethesda myself as well, and I'll give you a hint. Fish taco in Cabin John. Some of the better Mexican food around. Definitely a little place. Very good spot.
I've yet to go there because every time I go in that shopping center, I go to the market and get a club sandwich, which is fantastic.
The wild bird at the market is to die for, too. That's a great sandwich as well.
Yeah, so now I need to go to Fish Taco. I'm glad you recommended it.
It's a good spot for a fantasy draft, or if you just want to have a guy meet up for a sandwich or two, you know, a burrito or some Mexican and a beer. It's a great spot.
That's great to know, because like I said, every time I'm tempted to go in there, and then I'm like, no, I'm going to go with what I know.
Yeah, well, definitely do yourself the favor. So
I will.
So, all right, Craig, well, thank you so much for all this time on a Sunday. I really appreciate you enlightening me on fantasy and talking a little bit of prospects. I want to give you a spot here for your plugs, Twitter, where they can find your work online, and, you know, basically anything you want to plug.
Sure. My Twitter is at TV Goldstein, and I don't recommend following me. It's a train wreck, in my personal opinion, but people seem to enjoy it at times. The BP annual, the 2015 annual, is out right now. I contributed to the Orioles and Diamondbacks chapters, and I also did some of the blurbs for the 101. I think, you know, I'm obviously biased, but legitimately, I read it, and I think this is a great product. There's a lot of it that I wasn't involved with that is much better than the parts that I was, I'm sure. It's something I really recommend, you know, from the bottom of my heart. It's my favorite thing that I get to work on, and it's an honor to work on each year. There are some tremendous writers. There's an essay for each team, along with at least 65 player comments, with both comments and projections using Capota. It's just a ton of information, and it's something that people generally really enjoy, and so I don't have any problem recommending it. The top 101 on Baseball Prospectus is coming out on Monday, so we're recording this on a Sunday, so if it's out, you know, tomorrow, people will be able to go read it. A lot of hard work was put into that, and then I was talking about this before we started recording. Our fantasy staff is absolutely crushing this offseason. We do a positional series every week. So we've got outfield coming up. We have between 16 and 18 fantasy articles out every week. So we pretty much leave no stone unturned. So if you're looking for fantasy stuff, we've got you covered at BP. And then, like I said, the annual is really a ton of hard work goes into it. Our editors, Jason Bosposti and Sam Miller, are incredible people, and they turn out a really good product.
Yeah, I can't just reiterate everything you just said. Everything you said was perfect. So definitely go check out those products. The fantasy product is great. I remember to draft Corey Dickerson on my team this year. And that's really, I think I can summarize just with that. So thanks, Craig, so much for joining me today. I hope to see you around the park, whether it's a minor league park or at Nat Stadium, sometime here in the next few months.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, Ryan. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
All right, have a good one.
And that was my conversation with the man, the myth, the legend, Craig Goldstein. I want to thank him for joining me this week and educating me on fantasy baseball, and hoping to turn my luck around this season. I'm hoping to win this year a little cash. So thanks, Craig. Before we wrap episode 25, I want to mention that the Nats GM Show is available on iTunes. So please rate and review the podcast, as this does, in fact, help us gain additional listeners and attracts a larger and bigger audience to us. So please do that. I'd appreciate it. Furthermore, we are still seeking a principal sponsor for the podcast. So if you are interested, please visit natsgm.com for details. We're done for this week. Bye for now.